Thanks, Padmadaka. So Gampopa begins chapter 4 of the Jewel Ornament of Liberation with the following words. It's actually a question. Since we have Buddha nature as our driving force, as our working basis, the human body, and as a contributory cause of our development, the spiritual friends we have met, how is it that we have not obtained Buddhahood? You know, we've got all this wonderful equipment. How is it that we haven't attained enlightenment? Gampopa seems to assume that we've been enjoying these good conditions for some time. And he goes on to tell us that there are four main obstacles that prevent us from attaining Buddhahood, that prevent us from attaining enlightenment, liberation. These are, first of all, attachment to the experiences of this life. Secondly, attachment to worldly well-being. Thirdly, self-complacency. And fourthly, not knowing, not understanding how to gain enlightenment. And the spiritual friends, says Gampopa, provide us with instructions and with methods for removing these four obstacles. And they do this by teaching four antidotes to these four obstacles. And they ask that we contemplate, that we meditate on these four antidotes. So first of all, we meditate on transitoriness, the impermanence of all things. This is the antidote to attachment to experience. Secondly, we meditate on the suffering that is brought about through unskillful action. We meditate on karma and its results. This is the antidote to the attachment to worldly well-being. Thirdly, we cultivate love and compassion for all beings as the antidote to becoming self-complacent. And fourthly, we set up the factors that bring about the arising of the mind, the heart, that is set on enlightenment, what's called the bodhicitta. This is the antidote to not knowing how to attain enlightenment. So Gampopa's discussion of these four areas takes up four chapters of the book. There's a section for each of them, so it's an exhaustive treatment, providing much food for reflection. It won't be possible to comment on everything he says. We don't have the time for that. I'll simply select the things that have struck me most of all. So first of all, let's look at the first antidote. And this is the antidote, you remember, to attachment to experience. So this is giving concentrated attention to impermanence. Giving concentrated attention to impermanence. And Gampopa begins his discussion by saying that impermanence is obvious. He says, generally speaking, it is an empirical fact that everything composite is transitory. The Buddha himself has declared, monks, everything composite is transitory. Composite here means that everything that's made up of causes and conditions. All those things are impermanent. When you take the causes and conditions away, whatever is there comes to an end. This is the way it is. And he quotes a very ancient Buddhist text in which the Buddha says, the end of every hoarding is spending, of every rising falling, of every meeting parting, and of all living dying. These kinds of quotations that Gampopa give us, these short, neat, very direct communications, are there to you would memorize them and repeat them to yourself and reflect on them in sitting meditation and throughout the day. Very, very pithy communications of impermanence. The end of every hoarding is spending, of every rising falling, of every meeting, parting, and of all living, dying. Whatever begins comes to an end. If it's a beginning thing, it must be an ending thing. This, by the way, is when the Buddha first taught his enlightenment to his five former ascetic companions, his first five disciples. It was when Kondanya saw that all those things which arise pass away, that his Dharma eye opened, his eye of wisdom opened, and he gained insight, he gained stream entry. And it was at that moment that the Buddha recognized that his teaching could be communicated to other people. Just that realization, if it arises, it must pass away. If you just knew that, you know everything. Passing away is woven into the very nature of things. You just have to look and see. We don't need a philosophy degree to do this. Just look, as the great Zen master Dogen says, impermanence is a fact before our eyes. It's a fact before our eyes. Gampopa goes further. He doesn't just leave it there. He really wants to bring it right into the centre of our consciousness. So he asks us to contemplate, first of all, impermanence in what he calls the outer vessel. And by the outer vessel, he means the external world. And then he says you contemplate impermanence of the inner essence, and that's the living beings within that world. So in his meditations on the outer world, he describes the cosmos according to ancient Indian cosmology, the arising and passing away of world systems. From the top to the bottom of the cosmos, there is nothing that is permanent. Everything arises and passes away, all of it. Other cosmoses and world systems may arise. Buddhism's cosmology is truly cosmic. But whatever, they all arise and pass away. There's nothing that resists this law of impermanence. And then he brings the contemplation a bit nearer. He says, well, consider the seasons. Just notice how the seasons, how they change. He goes through spring and summer, autumn, winter. And how the nature of each season is different. Each season gives way to another. That's the way you notice the impermanence of things. And of course, with global warming, even the seasons, the nature of the seasons seem to be changing. We don't just notice this, we just notice out the corner of our eye. We really look. The change of the seasons is telling us something. It's telling us the truth of change, of impermanence. That's the world we're in. Remember, meditation on impermanence is there to cure attachment to experience. We want to hold on to things. We want all things to always stay the same. Because of that, we falsify our experience. We get stuck, so we suffer. So notice the changing seasons as a corrective to that. I mean, I always find it very poignant. Late summer, when everything is absolutely at its pitch of blooming. I really love that time of year. But even at the very pitch of its blooming, it's fading. It's so poignant to see a rose at its absolute pitch, and you know very well it's always moving over into fading away. I think Heidegger says somewhere, being never fully flowers. It can't fully flower, because as soon as it's fully flowered, it just fades away. And then Gampopa says, notice the rising of the sun, how it spreads its light across the world and its passage throughout the day. That's communicating impermanence. Notice the setting of the sun and the darkness spreading across the earth. That's expressing impermanence. Notice the moonrise and the waxing and waning of the moon. That's communicating impermanence. Pay attention, he says, to transitoriness in fleeting moments. Lovely phrase. Transitoriness in fleeting moments. Notice how the world is always changing. It seems to be the same. We seem to be in the same shrine room as yesterday. We all seem to be going on the same road that we walked upon the day before. But it's not the same, actually. Every moment, the world is different from the moment before. The world, says Gampopa, quoting Buddhist texts again, the world is actually like a waterfall flowing onwards, never the same. If we could really see that, we really would be getting somewhere in our spiritual life. If we really saw the transitoriness in fleeting moments, how could we cling and grasp and hold on to anything at anybody? There'd be a tremendous freedom just in that realization. You wouldn't really need to know very much else. Gampopa then asks us to contemplate the impermanence of the beings within this world, the impermanence of ourselves and others, and in particular, he asks us to contemplate death. And again, Gampopa's treatment of this subject is exhaustive. It's very, very thorough indeed. It could sound morbid, it could sound depressing, but that's not the point of his reflection. It's about contemplating our actual situation. Yes, we are alive, that's wonderful. We have this precious human body which we need to cherish and appreciate. But we live always in relationship to death. So obviously to meditate on this, we need to cultivate a very positive and an appreciative and a joyful mood. This is very, very important. It's not a beginner's practice, meditation on death. We have to be very, very careful with it. You really do need to have established yourself in a lot of metta bhavana to really meditate on death successfully. If you're getting depressed when you look at this sort of area, then you need to pull back from it. Now, I'm not going to go into give all the details of all the contemplations that Gampopa describes in his meditation on death. I'll just give you some of the main features. First of all, Gampopa asks us to meditate on the certainty of death. We really need to establish within the stream of our being that death is certain. There is no way of avoiding it and cheating it. It is unavoidable. It is inevitable. We might try to cheat it. We might try to pretend that it's not there. You know, in this cult of youth that seems to be around, you know, with all the cosmetic surgery, the sort of attempts to always look like a young person. It's just really the suppression of awareness of death. Just this constant way of keeping that at bay. Or unhealthy obsession with death. There's sort of a morbid obsession with it. That's actually a denial of the fact of death. It's a kind of fantasy about it. That's just as much an avoidance as pretending it's not where. It's not there. A morbid fascination with it. That's a fantasy about the reality of dying. We just need to get death into view, clearly. It will happen to us. No one is exempt. Not even the Buddha was exempt from dying. The Buddha died. They always make this point. They make the point, yes, the Buddha had this fantastic attainment and realization, but he died. He entered Parinirvana. His body died. Cheat death. You might find that when you read Buddhist texts that they talk about enlightenment as the end of birth and death, and enlightenment described as the undying. But that, of course, is meant in a highly poetic sense. It's not in the literal sense at all. Secondly, we need to reflect that the time of death is uncertain. We really need to get this into our consciousness. We don't know when we will die. We think it will happen. You know, we might say, yeah, of course I'll die. But, you know, later. Later, you know, a few years' time, when I'm old. And probably when we're old, we're thinking, well, you know, later on I'll die. Some other time. It happens to other people. It can happen at any time. And any moment. There is no fixed time for death. And the causes of death are many. There are so many ways in which we can die. Gampopa probably keenly aware of this. You remember in his life story, his wife and children died because of, you know, a plague. Life is actually very fragile and unstable. And Gampopa quotes from a Buddhist text, "This life has many dangers. It is more unstable than a bubble blown about by the wind, with breath coming and going. It is the greatest miracle that one ever awakens from sleep. With breath coming and going, it is the greatest miracle that one ever awakens from sleep." That's a very powerful reflection, I think. We are in a very fragile situation. The breath comes and goes. We give the air away in every moment. We're not actually certain that that breath will return. Now, this could be frightening, but it's not meant, Gampopa doesn't mean this, to induce panic and dread. And if that's happening to you, if you're finding that you're just getting into a state of panic and dread, well, just forget about it. Don't worry about it. The intention is to sober us up so that we make the most of our life while we can, that we live as meaningfully as possible while we have the time and while we have the opportunity. We're developing, if we reflect, what we should be developing is a keen appreciation for every moment. If you meditate on the impermanence of breath, you have a much deeper appreciation of the breath, and your concentration and your absorption in the process of breathing becomes even deeper. I find when I make much more time and space, and this usually happens on a solitary retreat, where I make much more time and space to meditate on transitoriness, impermanence, and contemplate my own death, I do feel much more sobered and much more challenged than I usually do. But I also find a very deep relaxation developing, because I'm accepting the reality of my situation. I think when I'm not doing that, there's a sort of level where there is an awareness of it, but it's kind of kept at bay. So that induces a sort of tension. So there's a great relaxation that can come when we accept the fact that we will die. We make the most of every moment, and we see the richness and potentiality in each moment. The third main contemplation that Gampopa gives us is that when we die, we can't take anything with us. You can't take it with you, can you? It's kind of ordinary wisdom. When we die, we can't take anything with us. We can't take the body with us. Obviously, we can't take it with us. That goes. No matter how beautiful, how well fed and adorned, no matter how fit we are, no matter how perfumed and massaged we are, we cannot take the beautiful body or even the ugly body with us. That all goes. We can't take family and friends and lovers with us. We can't. They don't come with us. We can't take wealth with us. All those things will be left behind. So they're not a source of security. They're not a source of refuge. They're deeply unreliable. There's an incredible passage from Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara where he's reflecting on death. And he says this: "For the sake of my likes and dislikes, I have done many kinds of unskillful action. I did not remember that sooner or later I must depart this life, abandoning all and alone. What I hate will cease to be. What I love will cease to be. I will cease to be, and all will cease to be. Night and day, my life advances to destruction. Nothing can stop it. I must surely die." So, great verses to meditate on. So we can't take anything with us. Everything will cease to be. And this could sound as if Gampopa is encouraging. You know, sometimes when we talk like this, a sort of cynical view on life, you sometimes find people saying that, oh, it's nothing's worth it, is it? We're all going to die, you're going to die, I'm going to die, so, you know, let's not bother. But that's not, if you're doing that, if you're living like that, you're missing the point. The purpose of the meditation is to remove attachment and clinging, which are essentially selfish and self-centered. It's about cultivating a sense, this meditation, of what is meaningful. So contemplation of death, our own and others' death, actually should bring about a transformation in our relationships with others. We're not attached to them, but we're not developing aversion and indifference to them either. You sometimes get this when you get teachings on non-attachment, people become sort of indifferent. That's not what you're cultivating. What arises, in fact, if you do this meditation properly, is metta, is loving kindness. There's a wonderful saying that I quote just about any chance I get to quote it from the Dhammapada, where the Buddha says, "Others do not know that we are all heading for death. Those who do know it will end their quarrels." So those who know that we're all heading for death will give up quarrelling, will give up fighting, will give up arguing. More positively, they'll always be coming into harmony with others. They'll always be coming into a relationship of loving kindness with others. And this particular phrase, "Others do not know that we're all heading for death. Those who do know it will end their quarrels," I'd really like to burn that into my heart. It's one of those sayings of the Buddha where I really feel that he's expressing insight, where I'm confident in his enlightenment. Such a simple thing, but it's such a powerful truth, you know, such an obvious truth. You know, if you quarrel with somebody and they die, or you're on your deathbed and there's an unresolved quarrel, there is no way you can resolve it. There's no way that you can sort it out. You might be able to do that within the confines of your consciousness, but in this life, you cannot sort it out. So when we know that we're heading for death, we don't get into quarrels. We don't get into that kind of standoff with people. On the contrary, we're keenly developing metta. When you know impermanence, when you know the inevitability of death, when you know the uncertain time of death, you don't quarrel anymore. When you know impermanence, you develop a deep appreciation of life. You cherish others, treat them with care, with metta, that clear, clean, non-clinging loving kindness for everyone, because you're keenly aware of the nature of all things and all beings. You're keenly aware of their impermanence. When you see impermanence, when you see the fact of your own and others' death, the only response to that is loving kindness. Gyanbopa concludes his discussion of the contemplation of impermanence by describing some of the benefits of such contemplation. He says, "The benefits of meditating on impermanence are that you give up hankering after the things of this life. You will nourish faith and confidence and strive energetically, and you will lay the foundation for the realization of the sameness of all things." So, meditating on impermanence, you won't be attached to and hankering after things which are of their nature impermanent. You'll develop faith and confidence in the way things are, and you will strive, you will make effort, because you know you don't have time to waste. And you'll lay the foundation for the realization of the sameness of all things. That last point points to the fact that contemplating impermanence will unfold into a deep mystical experience of the sameness of everything. So let's move on now to the second contemplation, the contemplation of suffering and karma. And this is to counteract the obstacle of attachment to worldly well-being. Again, Gampopa's treatment of this is exhaustive. There's two whole chapters devoted to this. One devoted to suffering, which Herbert Gunter translates very vividly as the vicious state of samsara. More modern translations just have the shortcomings of samsara. And the other chapter is on karma and its result. Before considering Gampopa's discussion of suffering, I think again we need to take great care. We need to take great care not to get the wrong idea. If you read books on Buddhism, you will very quickly encounter the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, which are usually explained as suffering, the cause of suffering, which is craving, the end of suffering, which is nirvana, and the path leading to the end of suffering, which is the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. It's a very famous Buddhist teaching. And you can get the idea reading some Buddhist books, and especially books by non-Buddhists on Buddhism. You get the impression that Buddhism must be a very miserable religion, because it involves seeing suffering everywhere. And you even get the idea, and I think even some Buddhists are guilty of this, that spiritual progress is sort of measured by the degree of suffering that you're undergoing, and that misery is more real than happiness. You can get that sort of impression. Some people do think that. Well, that is a wrong view, people. And there's a problem as well, because, you know, you get all this talk of suffering in Buddhist texts, and Buddhists, you know, are often happy and friendly people and, you know, easygoing. And they seem to kind of appreciate life, and they don't seem pessimistic, and you know, they don't seem like killjoys. It can be very, very baffling for people, this. So what's going on? Well, one of the best discussions I know of this is by Sangharakshita, our teacher. It's a wonderful little essay he wrote when he was a young man, when he was sort of grappling with these issues, called Where Buddhism Begins and Why It Begins There. And there's also a very good discussion of this in his magnum opus, A Survey of Buddhism. Now, I can't summarise all his points, but I'll just mention a few of them. First of all, suffering is not a metaphysical point. It's not metaphysics. It's not a description of reality. It's not a doctrine. If you like, if you wanted to describe the metaphysical nature of things, it would be conditioned co-production, that everything is conditioned, that everything is insubstantial. But it's definitely not that everything is suffering. It's definitely not, Buddhism definitely doesn't say that suffering is more real and more spiritual than happiness. The Buddha and his great disciples like Gampopa point to suffering as a means, a method. It's, if you like, a symptom that things aren't right, that we're not living in accord with the way things are. That's why we suffer. Look at our own experience of how we came to the spiritual life. We probably, at the root of it, there's some kind of suffering. It might be the suffering of illness or loss, or just that general dissatisfaction that's made us question life more deeply. And remember too that Gampopa recommends the contemplation of suffering to deal with an obstacle to spiritual progress, the obstacle of making ourselves comfortable in samsara, in the wheel of life. That's what he wants us to do. He wants us to, we have this great tendency to make ourselves comfortable. So even though it's painful, even though it's not very satisfying, we put up with it because it's what we know. There's a famous Tibetan saying, you can even make hell comfortable. People would rather suffer than because they, you know, they're used to it rather than do something about it. So suffering is a symptom that there are things to deal with. So Gampopa's discussion of suffering is under three main headings. First of all, the suffering of conditioned existence. Secondly, the suffering of change. And thirdly, the suffering of suffering. Gampopa explains them in that order, but I'm going to follow another tradition which explains them in reverse or order. But I'm going to use some of Gampopa's points to explore these. So first of all, the suffering of suffering. Here Gampopa just draws our attention to suffering in all the different realms of life. And the most pertinent to us, of course, is his discussion of the suffering of human beings. And Gampopa asks us to look at eight particular sufferings. First of all, the suffering of birth. Then the suffering of old age. Thirdly, the suffering of illness. Four, the suffering of death. Five, the suffering of being separated from those who are dear to us. Sixthly, the suffering of meeting those who are not dear to us. Seventhly, not to obtain what we desire, that's suffering. And eighthly, the suffering of guarding possessions. Seven and eight, Gampopa says, are easy to understand. So he says, I'm not going to discuss them. So just, you know, briefly, it's obviously a state of suffering, not getting what you want. And guarding possessions is a source of suffering. I'm sure if you look at the way, you know, the elaborate ways you hold on to things, well, that's quite painful. As with our discussions of impermanence of death, we could get the idea that Gampopa just has a negative and depressing view of life. But again, what he's doing is drawing attention to our situation, drawing our attention to the suffering woven into life. Sometimes when you hear people complain and moan or bemoan the various sufferings that befall them, it's as if it shouldn't be happening. It shouldn't be happening to them. They even get angry and frustrated that it's happening, and they want to lash out at others. Someone has to pay for my suffering. But being a human being means that you suffer. It's woven into things. It means accepting suffering. And we reflect on suffering and use it to understand our circumstances more clearly. So let's go through some of those sufferings he mentions. First of all, there's the suffering of birth. And Gampopa gives a description of the pain that the child in the womb undergoes. He was a medical man, but I think his biology is probably a bit dodgy, to say the least. But he does try to sort of, you know, paint a picture. It's actually very painful inside there. And the birth itself, he would have seen plenty of births in his life, Gampopa, I'm sure. Well, that's a very painful process. You know, it's a very, very painful process to be born. And he really lays it on. And it's a very dangerous time. You know, the mother could die. The child could die. I know some people might object because they were very moved by the birth of their son or daughter in that wonderful miracle of life emerging. But there is a lot of pain in birth. There's the shock of being born. Apparently, it's an enormous shock to be born, or it can be. So we need to reflect on this. Gampopa is stripping back a lot of the sentimentality that can surround birth. It's painful. And then there's the suffering of old age. He says, and I quote, "The sufferings of old age are immeasurable." You know, when you get to 50, you start sort of noticing that. Gampopa speaks of the complete changes in your hair, the colour, the texture of your hair, your skin, your complexion changes, your stature, you know, your health. You know, there's all sorts of health things. I mean, some of my friends who are really fit and, you know, really look after themselves, they're noticing some things, you know, about getting old. And the powers and the faculties of the mind start to go, you know, memory starts to go and all the rest of it. And a sense of life diminishing and the prospect of death. You know, as you get older, death definitely starts to call out to you. And there can be a lot of fear associated with that. Old age is a very poignant time indeed. I remember when my father's, as he got older, and sort of old age seemed to come so suddenly. It doesn't actually, but it seemed to come very suddenly. He seemed to go very quickly from being a, you know, into an old man. And sometimes he'd go up the stairs and I could hear him muttering as he went up to bed, "I've had enough of this." You know, just, it was so painful just going up the stairs. And sometimes I'd talk to him. I was very close to my father, and we'd have, you know, he was obviously really puzzled and baffled as to what was going on. You know, why is this happening? And I'd say, Dad, it's called old age. He said, well, other old men aren't like me. You know, which you kind of had a point. But I said, you know, but plenty are, Dad, you know, and they're a bit worse off, you know. And but this sort of bafflement, you know, at things not working as they used to work. So poignant. How is this possible? And of course, when you get older, it can be that young people don't want to be with you anymore. You're no fun. You know, just no fun, to use Iggy Pop's phrase. Not in this context, it has to be said. It's old age, it's decay, it's part of things, it's woven into life. It's not personal. It's the way it is. We grow old. And thirdly, there's the suffering of illness. Again, Gampopa lists the pain and indignities of illness. You know, it could be a virulent disease that just attacks you. There's being treated roughly by the physician. It happened in Tibet as well. Having to depend on strong medicines to keep you going. He sees that as a suffering. And strong medicines these days are kind of even, the effects are even worse, aren't they? Not being able to eat and drink what we want, you know, being put on a diet, you know, we can't have those rich foods anymore and all that coffee. Being forced to follow the doctor's advice. And again, fear of death. Again, illness and sickness happens. It's not personal. Yes, we should look after ourselves. We should take, you know, he's not saying that we should just sort of really go in for this, you know. You know, bring illness on, you know, it's not like that as you consume another cream cake. He doesn't mean that. He's not getting at that. He's trying to say, well, even if you should look after yourself and take care of yourself. But hey, it's going to happen. You can't avoid it. It's the way of things. And then there's the suffering of death. Death can be very frightening. The prospect of death can be very, very frightening indeed for some people. You know, and we don't know what we're going to be like when we're facing death. I mean, it would be nice if we could be very serene and, you know, go into it with full awareness. And, you know, we imagine our deathbed scene as being really wonderful with people around and everything. But it might not be like that at all. It might be very, very frightening. And then fifthly, there's the suffering of being separated from those who are dear to us. Well, it's painful. You know, to be parted from people we love, and family and friends. They will leave us. We will leave them. Inevitably, even if we're trying to be with them all the time. You can't be with them forever. They will die. We will die. This is so very, very painful and tragic. I found this, when I think about this in particular, this sort of deep tragedy to life. The reflections were started when I was sort of reflecting a bit on my father's death. He died a few years ago, and in particular, sort of reflecting, I think my mother and father had the idea that they'd sort, you know, they'd do everything, you know, been married for over 50 years, and that basically they'd kind of some vague idea that they kind of die together, you know, to go to heaven together. And of course it's just not like that. And I can remember when, just thinking of my mother, how painful it's been for her since my father's death. I mean, she's doing very well with it. But I just thought, well, life is so cruel, actually. You know, you make a connection with somebody. You know, you have to do that as a human being. It's so important to love and to have companionship and to have friendship. It's you know, so important to do that in life. But it ends, you know, the connection is broken. You part from the people that you love and they part from you. There's nothing that you can do about that. It happens even in a spiritual context. There's a very, very poignant scene towards the end of the Buddha's life when he's about to pass away. And Ananda, his faithful friend and companion and the person who looked after him for many, many years, he just suddenly broke down. He'd been kind of organising all these people to come and be around the Buddha and to meet the Buddha, telling everybody, look, he's dying, you know, come and see. And he's just overwhelmed. He just suddenly realises what's going on. The person he's closest to is actually dying, and it's just too much. He breaks down. And the Buddha calls Ananda to him, and he says, "Don't weep. Don't weep. Haven't I told you, Ananda, that we all have to part from everyone and everything that we love and cherish? How could it be otherwise? How could it be otherwise? You know, everything and everybody that we love and cherish, we have to part from them. There's no way of it being any other way." Now, this sort of teaching, sometimes when people read this in pujas, they make the Buddha sound like a sort of, I don't know, a kind of firebrand preacher, you know, Ananda, you know, blah, blah, you know, see impermanence. I can't believe that he'd say it like that. You know, he'd say it with great love and compassion and kindness. And some people think that living a Buddhist life makes you cold and disconnected. You know, that you sort of have this kind of equanimity and non-attachment, and you just watch the coming and going of things, and you're kind of coldly detached. That is not, I believe, the true Buddhist angle on things. You love, in the sense of developing metta, with full awareness of the impermanence of everybody and the impermanence of yourself, in full knowledge that this will end, that you will part. That is the great challenge of Buddhist spiritual life, that you love fully and well, you know, with clarity and without attachment, in full awareness of the impermanence of things. So important to get that. Then sixthly, there's the suffering of meeting those who are not dear to us. Well, we do find ourselves in situations with people we don't like, and maybe they don't like us as well. And this is unavoidable, actually. Of course, we try to avoid it. We try to arrange a life that always seems to, you know, where we're always with people we like being with and they like us. We try to set it up like that, you know, maybe, you know, we think this is the person, this is the person, this is the group of people when everything will be all right. But life always seems to have this kind of tricky way of contriving to always put us with people somewhere, somehow, who we end up not liking, and them not liking us. It's just the way of things. And strangely enough, this happens especially in the Sangha, in the spiritual community. It's really weird, this. You know, there you think you'd come together with other Buddhists, you know, who, you know, you share your spiritual ideals and values, and it's great, you know, I'm really with these people. And of course it is, but actually you start finding, you look around sometimes and you think, God, really weird group of people, you know, and find yourself getting irritated with them, and actually start noticing, well, they're getting pretty irritated with some of your habits as well. And of course, one of the reasons for this is the fact that within the Sangha, what we're brought together by is our common spiritual commitment to spiritual life. And that actually is beyond likes and dislikes. But you're thrown together with people who, if you lived your life in another way, you wouldn't be with. I remember a friend of mine who was running a Buddhist business, kind of team-based business, kind of reached a kind of crisis, because he said, well, when I used to employ people in my old business, if I didn't like them, I fired them. He said, I can't do that in the Sangha. You can't do that. And this is a very powerful practice. This is one of the great gifts of Sangha and spiritual friendship, that you're brought up against all sorts of people and you start to change yourself rather than trying to mould the world, which is impossible, just to suit your own desires. So if you're finding you have all sorts of likes and dislikes on this retreat of the people here, that's normal. It's okay. You just have to transform yourself so, you know, that you have metta for them rather than having likes and dislikes. Great, isn't it? And spiritual progress takes place because of this. What Sangharakshita calls mutual modification of being. And that's how Sangha is a practice. So Gampopa, in explaining the suffering of suffering, is pointing to these very obvious sufferings in life. They're unavoidable, actually. Even if you were a Buddha, you would undergo them. The Buddha suffered illness, terrible illness and disease. You know, his last days, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Pali Mahaparinibbana Sutta, when you read it closely, you realise he was really, you know, he was really messed up physically. He had terrible back pains, terrible stomach pains. He had terrible dysentery, which is, a terrible illness. He says at one point, "I'm like an old bullock cart, you know, that can only keep going by being lashed together with bits of rope." That's how he's just kind of holding his body together. But, and of course this is crucial, the Buddha had a completely different relationship to this suffering. He saw it for what it actually is, and it didn't provoke in him fear and aversion. That's what happens with us. You know, we're often frightened and we have aversion to the suffering that we're experiencing. So, you know, we often bury our head in the sand and try to, you know, pretend that it's not happening rather than face it. It said always of the Buddha's suffering, his physical suffering, that he bears it mindfully and fully aware. He bears it mindfully and fully aware. The brightness of his mind is undimmed, and also undimmed is his metta, his loving kindness and his compassion. Even when he was an old man of 80, when he was in a lot of physical pain, extreme physical pain, he still walked along the roads of northern India, communicating the Dharma to anybody who came to him. Though the last days of the Buddha are, I think, one of the... Somebody asked me recently, if I could go back to the Buddha's life, which period would I like to go back to? And I said, I'd like to go back to the last days. I'd like to see how an enlightened man deals with old age and illness and death. See the Buddha's mindfulness and love and compassion in the face of that. That's where I want to aim my practice, I suppose. So looking into suffering changes our relationship to it. And remember, the purpose of the reflection is overcoming the obstacle of attachment to worldly well-being. Attachment to worldly well-being can also be called denial. Hear a lot about denial, don't we, these days? Denial here means convincing ourselves that everything is okay, it's all right, trying to be normal, putting on a happy face, when actually you're deeply troubled by what's going on, deeply troubled deep down about decay and illness and death and loss and falling out with people, but you're still going, it's okay, everything's fine, and it's all falling apart. We need to face the fact of our suffering. These things are reminders. They're telling us something about life. It's all information telling us that there are deeper things to attend to. There's a truth to live by. And Gampopa takes the discussion of suffering even further. We haven't finished with suffering yet. There's the suffering of change, the suffering of transformation. And what Gampopa means by this is that whatever happiness we enjoy in samsara, in worldly life, tends to turn into its opposite. The happiness of possessing something that we have wanted very much can often turn into suffering when we lose it. Or there can be that great joy of getting something. You know, we've really been looking to this something, and then it turns out, once we've got it, it's not what we thought it was going to be. We feel so disappointed. And I remember Christmas time was like that. I mean, Christmas as a kid, it was always the night before that was the best. And just looking at those presents. But after you'd opened them, you know, Christmas Day afternoon, bad time. maybe I just didn't get the right present. Whatever, we lose things. So even if it's something really fantastic that we've got, we're going to lose it. We're going to lose the possessions. We're going to lose the people. Sangharakshita also explains this as this suffering of change and transformation as a sort of psychological suffering. we have, not necessarily that consciously, not as an insight certainly, a sense somewhere that things can pass, can change, can be taken away. And instead of really making that the basis of our life, instead of that, we kind of suppress it. We kind of suppress it. So that means that there's a level of anxiety and tension, because we kind of know that they're going to pass away. But we're not really prepared to take that on. So there's this suffering, this sense of transformation and the suffering that comes from that. The Buddha, it said, doesn't have this kind of suffering because he knows that things will pass. He might have physical suffering, but not this kind of suffering. He relaxes into the transitoriness of things, into the flow of things. And thirdly, there's the suffering of conditioned existence. This is known traditionally as upadana skanda dukkha, the suffering that comes from taking up with the five grasping skandhas. Skandhas, literally means heaps or groups, describe the conditioned individual. I'm not going to go into them in detail. What Gampopa is drawing attention to is a deeper, more subtle suffering. Suffering isn't probably the best word to translate this. It's more like dissatisfaction. Gampopa even says that it will only really be experienced by saintly people. It's that subtle suffering of unenlightenment, that dissatisfaction with conditioned, restricted being. Perhaps we feel it when that Buddha potential, that Buddha motive begins to vibrate within us, that longing for spiritual freedom starts to happen. When we feel that our spiritual creativity, if you like, is being blocked, restricted by our conditioned nature. The way we define ourselves as a self, as against other people, that's painful, actually. That's the pain of conditioned being. Everything else might be okay. We might be well and happy, but there's this deep dissatisfaction, this sense of restriction. It's very important to notice this kind of suffering. This is the grit, the magic grit, this kind of dissatisfaction. This is the magic grit that creates the pearl of the mind of enlightenment. This is the magic grit that overcomes the obstacle of attachment to worldly comfort, that motivates us, that keeps us motivated. So again, we're back to motive, and this brings us to Gampopa's next big topic, which is karma and its result. We're going on. It's a few more pages. Okay, it's a long talk this morning, so we can do Gampopa justice. So do bear with me. There's no talks for the next 2 days. I know there's a lot of words, but do bear with me. So yes, karma and its result. So Gampopa asked us to reflect on karma and its result, or karma and its fruit, as part of the antidote to the obstacle of attachment to worldly comfort. Again, his discussion is very thorough. There's a whole chapter devoted to this, the whole of chapter 6, and I certainly don't have time to go into it in any detail. Essentially, what Gampopa wants to show us is that our happiness and our suffering are in our own hands. Karma means literally action, action proceeding from intention. Willed action, and it's our suffering and happiness is entirely dependent on what we will, on the willed actions that we perform of body, speech, and mind. And Gampopa goes through in particular 10 unskillful, unwholesome actions that lead to suffering. So I'll mention these unskillful actions. There's killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, telling lies, speaking harshly, speaking frivolously, slander, coveting, indulging in ill will or hatred, and holding false views. Order members will notice here that these are the opposite of the 10 precepts that we take at the time of our ordination. The 10 precepts that we take in the order are abstention from all of these things in gross and subtle form. Gampopa also shows, and though there's less detail here, how behaving skillfully, practicing the Buddhist precepts, leads to happiness and well-being. And there's also a discussion of how karma works itself out. And like I say, Gampopa's discussion is thorough. He also communicates the basic message. And it's the basic message that I really want to communicate here. At the beginning of the chapter, he makes the point, following general Buddhist tradition, that the important, crucial factor to any action, any karma, is your motivation, the quality of your mind, the quality of your intention. That is the decisive factor. Your suffering, your happiness, your enlightenment, your creativity, your sense of meaning is down to what you do with your mind. Mind is regarded as extremely powerful in Buddhism. It's an action and a deed in itself, and it motivates our activities. Having said that, we shouldn't think, though, that bodily and vocal actions are unimportant. They certainly are. They affect our minds. But the really important point being got across here is that Buddhist life comes from the inside. Yeah, it's not about fitting in with rites and rituals and ceremonies as ends in themselves. You get your mind, your heart right, and then your world will be transformed. As I've said, there's no time to really explore this, but I do want to head off some wrong views about karma. And the main one is this, that karma is like fate. Popularly, this is the way karma explained. It's my karma, you know. You're doomed to do something bad, or you're doomed to suffer because you must have done bad things in the past. This is actually much more of a sort of Hindu view of karma. And it's interesting with Hinduism, they relate it, of course, to your social standing. They relate it to caste. If you're born to a so-called low caste, or worse still, born an outcast, a so-called untouchable, don't try to change. This is what Brahminical tradition would say. Don't try to improve yourself if you're born, you know, poor, if you're born into an outcast community. If you suffer, you'll purify the evil you've done in the past. And here, we'll help you suffer. So this is a notion of karma which is mixed in with religio-social power hierarchies. And it's not Buddhist at all. It's not Buddhist at all. The Buddha absolutely refuted caste. It's not birth, it's worth that makes a man. And the Buddha's point, the Buddhist tradition says very clearly, at any time you can change the effects of anything that you've done. So you're never doomed. Karma isn't like fate. You can change the effects of previous actions. So karma is not an iron law. We're not fated and destined to suffer. We can always do something. This is so important. Another wrong view, a serious wrong view, is that all suffering now is the result of bad things that we've done in past lives. You've got cancer? Well, you must have done something bad in a previous life. Well, that's not necessarily the case at all. How do you know that? Yeah, how do you know that at all? And what a dreadful thing to do it can be, I think, to people psychologically. I mean, not only have you got a physical problem, actually, you've got a serious spiritual problem. You know, you've done bad things in the past life. I think it's a dreadful way of approaching things. I mean, with the tsunami, that dreadful tidal wave that happened, I did hear some stories that some Tibetan lamas had said that the suffering of all those people was to do with their bad karma, because a lot of them were fishermen and they'd killed lots of fish. So this is the way they were paying off that debt of suffering. This is dreadful. This is so simplistic and so dogmatic and not Buddhist. I mean, the workings of karma are very, very mysterious and are not to be reduced to a sort of Buddhist dogmatism at all. And for Westerners, karma can be another version of a sort of guilt trip. It can be, you know, it can be sort of tied up. It can be the kind of new version of original sin, if you like. You're a bad person. You've done bad in your past. Well, who can tell? Who knows? And the Buddha, in the earliest Buddhist text, says very, very clearly, states categorically that not everything that happens to you is the result of your past karma, is the result of your past actions. He absolutely refutes that view quite clearly. There are all sorts of conditioning factors that bring things about. So we need a much more sophisticated view of these things. There's a very good book by one of our order members named Nagapriya on karma and rebirth. I really recommend it because he really discusses this area in a lot of detail, with a lot of sophistication, really looking at the different traditions on karma in Buddhism. The most important thing that Gampopa is trying to communicate, and that Buddhism is trying to communicate about karma, is that we establish right now in the stream of our being a skillful and a wholesome motivation for everything we do. That's the really important point. Not, you know, whether we were, I don't know, something nasty in our previous lives. We establish right now in the stream of our being a stream of skillful and wholesome motivation. This is why meditation is so important, because that's what you're doing in meditation. You're setting up that stream of skillful motivation, and that expresses itself in action, and that we perform actions that help us to develop that skillful stream of motivation. That's the real meaning of Buddhist ethics. So this brings us to the antidote to the third obstacle to spiritual progress, and that obstacle, you may recall, is self-complacency. So by self-complacency, Gampopa means desiring to attain nirvana for ourselves and not working for the benefit of others, because we have no love for living beings. Now, it's understandable when we embark on our spiritual journey that we think of gaining liberation from suffering for ourselves. Maybe we've come along to the Dharma in a bit of a state of one kind or another. And yes, we do a lot of work on ourselves, fair enough. But our spiritual practice needs to open out, needs to embrace others. If it doesn't, well, our so-called spiritual life becomes another version of self-centeredness, and we become imprisoned by our own pseudo-spiritual self-definition. There is a sort of preciousness that can sometimes develop in people when they take up a spiritual life, you know, whereby, oh, I'm not going to see those people. I'm not going to do that because they bring me down or something like that. Well, you know, you've got to start dealing with that. So we need to cultivate, as soon as we can, love and compassion. By love, we mean maitri, and the Pali word for that is metta. And it's why the metta bhavana practice is so very important, and why we teach it so early, if you like. Some people fear we maybe teach it too soon, but we need to transform our relationships with others as soon as we can, and I think that's especially important in our present age, with its increasing atomization. Gampopa underlines the importance of love and compassion by quoting a famous Buddhist master named Manjushri Kirti, who says, "A follower of the great way to enlightenment must not be without love and compassion for a single moment. A follower of the great way to enlightenment must not be without love and compassion for a single moment, for a single moment." So if we're seriously committed to the great way, to the Mahayana, we need to be aspiring to make love and compassion ever present. It's also said that love and compassion serves the needs of both self and others. For others, well, it's obvious. Everybody needs love and kindness. Everybody needs help. Everybody needs consideration. For self, enlightenment, liberation, is only possible through seeing through the fiction of a belief in a really existing self. Love and compassion is the easy and straightforward and practical way to see through that fiction. And again, Gampopa gives a whole chapter to the development of love and compassion, and again we'll have to be brief. And he begins his discussion by first of all speaking about love and then moving on to compassion. This is important. Compassion arises from love. Compassion arises from metta. So first of all, we need to develop that straightforward loving kindness towards others. Not a clinging love, not a sentimental love, an exclusive love, not a romantic or sexual love, but love that's a strong, straightforward friendliness without strings attached for everyone, that's actually expressed in action, in deeds. We treat people as people, beings as beings. We treat them with respect and decency. We cherish them as we cherish ourselves. Now, it's when this kind of love, this metta, encounters suffering, then it naturally becomes compassion, which is not pity, not sentimentally weeping over the fate of others, but the desire to help and to relieve pain. Again, practically expressed. And Gampopa tells us that there are three kinds of love. Love with reference to living beings. Love with reference to the stream of phenomena. And thirdly, love without reference to any particular thing. So Gampopa says very little about the last two kinds of love. He wants us to just learn to love living, breathing, sentient beings. But I'd like to make a comment about those last two deeper kinds of love. Because what they represent is a deeper seeing. Sometimes people say, oh, the metta-bhavanas, that's a beginner's practice. No. It's a very advanced practice, actually. What you start doing in the metta-bhavana is start seeing the nature of others more deeply. In the second kind of love, love with reference to the stream of phenomena, you see that others don't have a fixed personality. They're a stream of ever-changing state. So one's loving awareness of them is highly attuned to their changing nature. And of course, it makes it a much more effective loving kindness. And the third kind of love, love without reference to any particular thing, any particular object, well, that's deeply mysterious, of course. This comes about when you contemplate the profound mystery of beings, the profound mystery of reality. In this kind of love, there's no subject and object, there's no self and other. It's a sort of free-floating loving kindness that's sort of spontaneously pouring out of emptiness. It's natural, naturally flowing. But let's return to love for living beings. We must begin there. That's where love begins and ends. And Gampopa begins his discussion of this with these words. The causal characteristic of love is the desire that all beings may find happiness. So that's metta. It's that overwhelming desire, that constant desire that all beings may find happiness and well-being. In the ancient Pali text, they speak of wishing people sukhi tata, which literally means may they be happy selved. May they have happiness from within themselves. So you're wishing them a deep happiness. And that's how you can tell if you have metta. Ask yourself, do I want this person to be well, to be deeply well, to be deeply happy? And in order to generate that, Gampopa tells us that we need to ponder, to contemplate the benefits that we've received from others, actually from all others. And he recommends a very common Tibetan meditation, but it will sound rather strange to us. Gampopa says, first of all, think of your mother. Think of what she did for you. She gave birth to you. She fed you. She clothed you. She played with you. She helped you in so many ways. Form a vivid picture in your mind of your mother. And he says, naturally, of course, when you do that, gratitude will develop towards your mother. And out of that, very naturally, you will feel great love for her. You'll want the very best for her. Well, that's fair enough. It's very good, very important to reflect on what we've been given by our mother, our father, our teachers, our friends. We talked a bit about gratitude yesterday. Then Gampopa goes further. He just says, well, actually, every single being has been your mother at one time. Gampopa, of course, accepts rebirth. He lives by rebirth. That's part of his worldview. We've been born countless times. There are countless beings. So, at some time or another, every single being has been your mum. All of them have given you so much. So, if you reflect in that way, it will be easy to love all beings out of gratitude towards them. Now, I'm sure that's very effective for a Tibetan, but I'm not so sure it would be so effective for Westerners, for all kinds of reasons. You know, not least because we maybe don't think in terms of rebirth. So this is why we prefer in the FWBO to teach this ancient Indian Buddhist practice of the metta bhavana that goes back to the Buddha himself. Actually, Gampopa also recommends this practice in the meditation section of the Jewel of Liberation. So, metta bhavana. Bhavana literally means to make, to become. So, what you're doing in this practice, it's you're making to become metta. It's the becoming of metta. So, it's a gradual unfolding of loving kindness. Bhavana can also mean transformation. So you can also speak of this practice as the transformation through loving kindness, the transformation of yourself and your world. And you work with what you already have. Like I said last night, people sometimes say, oh, it's too difficult, I can't do it. Well, you must be missing something because you have friendliness. Everybody has it to some extent. And you start from that. You give that friendliness, the friendliness you already have, you give that attention. That's another way karma works. If you meditate on something, it will grow. So if you meditate on the friendliness that you have, it will grow and unfold. So I don't think I need to go through the stages of the metta. I went through those last night. But yes, so through that practice, you're developing metta. And as I said just now, it's a very profound spiritual practice. It goes very deep. It's a beginner's practice and an advanced practice. The whole path actually is contained in this metta bhavana. The Buddha describes the effects of metta in a very famous sutta about metta. And he ends by saying, whether he walks, sits, or lies down, all the time he is awake to wielding this spiritual power of loving kindness. This is the highest, the exalted state. So that's the way the Buddha speaks about it. So that's what we're aiming to be. We're aiming to have that flow of loving kindness going on all the time. I said earlier that compassion arises when our metta, our love, sees the suffering of others. And we respond by wanting to liberate people, living beings, from that pain. So through cultivating love and compassion, we overcome the obstacle of self-complacency. And for Gampopa, that means having real wisdom. You know, if we want to alleviate the suffering of others, we need real wisdom. We need the wisdom of a Buddha. And that means treading the path to enlightenment. Then you'll know what to really give to others. And that means committing yourself to that path by going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, and awakening the great heart intent upon wisdom and compassion. When you do that, you overcome the obstacle of not knowing how to gain enlightenment. So the antidote to the obstacle of not knowing how to gain enlightenment will be the subject of next week's talks. So stick around. If you're going, you're going to miss out. But I think actually from everything I've said this week, covering the first seven chapters of the Dawn of Liberation rather breathlessly, Gampopa has already given us enough to be getting on with. We could probably quite usefully stop and meditate for the next month on all this. Let's end with Gampopa's own words on the perfection of compassion, the merits of compassion. Let's give the final words to Gampopa. The measure of perfection of compassion means that when we have broken the fetters that hold us to deem ourselves better than others, and when the wordless desire to liberate all sentient beings from misery has risen, perfection of compassion is present. The merits that accrue from having practiced compassion cannot be measured. As it says in the text, when there is one virtue present, it is as if all the qualities of the Buddhas are in the palm of one's hand. Which virtue? Great compassion. In the Dharma Sanghiti Sutra, it says, exalted one, so it is. When there is the precious wheel of the universal monarch, there are also his troops. Exalted one, so where there is the Bodhisattva's great compassion, there are all the other Buddha qualities also. And in the Tathagata Chintya Guhya Nidesha, Guhyapati, the spiritual awareness of the enlightened one has grown out of the root of compassion. In this way, desiring that beings may attain happiness by love and be freed from misery by compassion, we are unable to reserve the happiness of tranquility for ourselves alone. Thus, a remedy is found against self-complacency by the joyful realization that Buddhahood may be attained. When someone in whom love and compassion are born praises others as greater than himself, he becomes filled with excellence. This may be seen from the example of the great Brahmadatta and is taught in the following verse. He who seriously wants to dispel all the misery of others is an excellent man, because in the stream of his own being, he has understood the nature of misery.